Now on to our bloggers roundtable. This week, who speaks for Black America? Plus using hip-hop to empower young women. And the growing influence of Black bloggers. With us today is freelance writer and blog consultant LaShawn Barber. Her blog is LaShawn Barber's Corner. Wayne Hicks, known in the blogosphere as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village. And writer and social activist Yabachi Boswell of the blog BlackPerspective.net. Welcome, folks.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
So, LaShawn, I'm going to start with you. The Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Leonard Pitts wrote an article recently for the Miami Herald. He asked basically why certain folks, mostly white folks, go to high-profile African-Americans like the Reverends Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson when they need to apologize for saying or doing something racist, like celebs using the N-word. So, do people like the Reverends Jackson and Sharpton speak for you?
Definitely not, and they certainly don't speak for a lot of Black people I know. I actually thought the column was kind of funny, and I was thinking about that. Part of the blame is are the lazy media, in my opinion. Whenever they need a soundbite from someone Black or someone in the Black community, go to the same people, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. And then I guess when high-profile white people get into trouble, those are the people that they go to. I'm sure there would have been people in the Black community who would have defended this guy Dog. I'm not familiar with the show. He's bounty hunter. Used the word the N-word in a private conversation, but you know, those are the people that he chose to go to because that's what he knows. That's what the media props up. They run to Jesse Jackson to get a soundbite. So the media are partly to blame for this.
Yabachi, do you think that this is a question of also whether or not people who are being constantly asked for this kind of shelter from the racial storm should say, you know what, I can't counsel you. Literally Dog, not my dog, but Dwayne Dog Chapman. Dog, I can't counsel you here.
There's a couple of things about this. This is not a new phenomenon. White people have always isolated their select leaders then to dictate back to Black people who our leaders are. So that's not even a new phenomenon. And as far as whether they should choose to counsel him or not, that's a personal thing. I don't think we should give absolution to any and everyone who first assaults us and then thinks they can just have any refuge to run to a couple of individuals to say, okay, now it's okay because these couple of individuals gave me absolution.
Wayne, there's a question that Leonard poses. Who are white America's leaders? It's not one that usually comes up in the calculus of race, but do you have anyone that you would throw out there if you had to, you know, they have a little title, white leader?
It's unusual. Ordinarily, the white community would go to their political leaders or to people that have been are in office. And so obviously President Bush becomes the name that comes to mind. As Yabachi said, historically, white folks just enjoy putting us in a box and saying this is your leader. Yep. And this is who we want you to be. You can go to almost any major metropolitan area and look at the major newspaper and they will run an article every year on who the top, you know, 5 or 10 Black leaders in town are. And if you were to ask the Black folks in town if those indeed are the leaders, they'd shake their head, that knowing that they're not. They might be the moneyed people. They might be the folks that are in corporate boardrooms that the power structure feels comfortable with. But it's a phenomenon that's been going on ever since I think they were very frightened with the reaction to Martin Luther King's assassination and very frightened about the control that Malcolm X had over a number of folks. And so for these last 40, 50 years, they've been trying to keep tabs and control over who our quote-unquote leaders are.
Has the whole question moved to a more local level? I mean, Wayne, do you think that now it's just a question of having local leaders as opposed to national ones?
I think the reality is we do have local leaders. We do have leaders that are in our community that are known by the people in the community. The fact is the mainstream media doesn't call upon them, and Dog the Bounty Hunter, you know, wouldn't know to call upon them and wouldn't give them the type of notoriety or the type of play on the mainstream media that folks like Dog or Michael Richards felt that they needed. But there's no question we have leaders right now that are in a variety of places, not necessarily political elected leaders. They might be folks that are leading community organizations. They might be folks that are leading neighborhood organizations. They exist right now. They just don't get the publicity that Reverend Jackson and Reverend Sharpton get.
LaShawn, I want to move on to a story about female empowerment of sorts. A group of high school girls in Atlanta got tired of catcalls and harassment by men, and they decided to fight back. They formed a group called Hot Girls. It stands for Helping Our Teen Girls in Real Life Situations, and they're using hip-hop to make a statement about the culture they live in, help them deal with self-esteem issues, relationships. Take a listen.
I'ma give you your number back, yup. Cause I don't like you when your game is whack, yup. You see, these boys just don't know how to act, yup. I try to walk away, but they talk smack, yup. Take it to the streets. Dirty boy, uh-huh. You try to play with me like I'm a
toy. All right, so that is the beat of Justin Timberlake, but it's not quite JT. It's,
right.
You know, what do you think? Is this going to make a difference?
Well, I'm not a big fan of rap music, but if this is a way that these young ladies can speak out against the disrespect that they feel that they're getting from men and or from people in the rap industry specifically, I say more power to them. You know, you reach people where they are. If people are online, you go there. If they're listening to rap music and you can find a way to reach them through that genre, go for it.
Yabachi, there's that whole question. Can you tear down the master's house with the master's tools? What do you think?
Right. I think that premise, that analogy is a false analogy in the first place. Framing hip-hop as something that's necessarily anti-women is just false because hip-hop is just what it is. It's very malleable. You can use it how you like to use it. And if you want to use it to empower yourself for a particular voice, then that's what it's going to be. It's going to be to you whatever you want it to be. It's like a gas. It takes the shape of whatever jar it's in. So whoever the user of the art form is, it's going to serve that purpose. It can serve either a purpose of being gangsterism, or it can serve a purpose of being political knowledge. It can serve a purpose of being sexist, or it can serve a purpose of being empowering for women. It's whatever the user of the art form chooses for it to be.
Wayne,
so the whole ideal and analogy and the premise, I think, is just a false one to begin with.
But Wayne, do you think that in general teen girls get a lot of voice over hip-hop? Because most of the artists, I mean, overwhelmingly the artists are men, and we could have another two-hour conversation about why that is. But teen girls listen to the music. They're not creating it. Is there really enough of a lever for them to make their voices known?
I mean, what I hope happens is that the idea of elevating the self-esteem of the women that made up, the young girls that made up that organization, the idea of letting the men, the young men in their environment know that they won't accept disrespectful comments and disrespectful behavior. I think that's the idea that I kind of gleaned from the article, and it's really what I enjoyed. Whether they continue to use hip-hop music as their vehicle moving forward, who knows? But the idea that they were able to create an organization that's gotten them some national publicity, that's raising their self-esteem, that's raising, you know, funds, to me, that's the power of what they've done and what hopefully can be replicated in other communities.
I think the organization is more important than that music part of it as well.
Yeah, I would like to add something about the power. People just don't realize how much power they have. You have an idea. You have something that you want to change. And you can get together, find the motivation within yourself to make this change. These girls did this, and now we're on NPR talking about it. I mean, I think that's wonderful. If rap is the vehicle that they're using, as I said, you know, they need support.
LaShawn, let me take LaShawn to another topic, all you guys. University of California system thinking about revising its admissions criteria. It'll allow them to consider a student's extracurricular achievements, community service, handicaps overcome. It would be basically a way of shaking up the test-based, grades-based admissions policy. LaShawn, you're writing about this. What do you think?
Well, I think it's just a proxy for race. As you know, back in 96, California was barred from using race, sex, nationality, creed, things like this in public hiring, contracting, and admissions. And I think that to use race preferences blatantly, this is something that the UC University of California system doesn't want to do. So they're adopting this so-called comprehensive approach to de-emphasize grades and scores and emphasize leadership qualities, extracurricular activities, what I call hard luck stories. My question is, why would any minority student, which doesn't include Asians, by the way, why would their stories, their non-academic factors, be more compelling than anyone else's? What I predict is going to happen is that the comprehensive review is going to be applied more heavily to Black and Hispanic students and less so to white and Asian students, whether these white or Asian students are poor or not, whether they have outstanding extracurricular activities or not. I think it's just an ill-fitting disguise for race preferences.
Now, Yubachi, there are a lot fewer Black and Latino students in the UC system now. The University of Michigan, which went through this whole debate over affirmative action, has reported many fewer Black and American Indian students. When you look at the questions of admission, is there a compelling interest for having a diverse population on campus? And if so, is this the right way to go, this kind of reassessment of the admission system?
I think so. What we have to understand is if you continue a process that does not allow everyone access to a higher level of education and the opportunity to move forward, then you basically continue your society in the same shell that it's been in. And what Ms. Barber doesn't really describe and seem to promote is that the new system that the University of California is promoting is one that just takes in various factors into account for giving people access. So therefore, if you're in a school that is underperforming, the top 4% of people from each school have an opportunity to automatically qualify, as opposed to the old system where it was a certain percentage of everyone overall. That means no matter what school you went to, or no matter what access to education you had coming up, if you did the work that you were given to do and you did the best you could with what you had, you have the exact same opportunity as the next person. And that's what we should be all about, giving people to progress, giving people a chance to progress forward in society.
Otherwise, but the question... The question is racial discrimination the method that you want to employ to ensure this diversity on campus? If you're admitting equally...
That's a false claim to call it racial discrimination. That's the statement.
Well, if a certain percentage of Black students with huge gaps in scores from white students or Asian students are getting admitted, then by definition, those white and Asian students are being discriminated against to make room for those lesser qualified Black students.
I have to jump in and give Wayne a chance. It's your last chance, man. Do you have any opinions on this matter?
Well, first, I'm a University of California graduate, so I got much love for UC for trying to do the right thing. I would agree with Ms. Barber that it's a shell or it's a proxy for race-based preference, and I would just go the other way with it, that what we need is race-based preference. It's evident that African-Americans are not being admitted into University of California, other major universities, as you cited the statistics. It's because of racial discrimination that keeps them out. We therefore have to have race-based initiatives such as affirmative action to put them where they should be in the first place. My hope is that we get rid of this thing that Ronald Reagan brought to us about thinking of affirmative action as what Ms. Barber called it, racial discrimination or quotas, and get back to race-based solutions for racial problems.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, folks. Wayne, Yubachi, LaShawn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Wayne Hicks, otherwise known as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village. He was at member station WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. Also writer and social activist Yubachi Boswell of the blog Black Perspective. He was at Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee. And freelance writer and blog consultant LaShawn Barber. Her political blog is LaShawn Barber's Corner. She was at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation does not stop here. Our online series Speak Your Mind gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind.